as possible. And you ought to participate in everything that allows them to see what a Christian is. But the moment you compromise by making your gospel palatable to them by worldliness, you have lost every hope you ever had in reaching that person for Christ. Now listen to verse 13. Let us go forth therefore unto him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. Now that's the other kind of witness. If Jesus Christ had given himself inside, he never would have become redemptive in our society. It was only when he went outside, he took his position of raising the world toward God apart from the world and died outside the camp, that he became the world's redeemer. And not until that happened was he able to redeem the world. So here we have a contrast between two ways to witness. It's the difference between Abraham and Lot when they both faced Sodom. Sodom enticed them, said, come my way. Lot said, I'm going. And all he did at first, he said, this is so innocent. I'm just turning my face toward Sodom. I'm pitching my tent in that direction. I'm not going to compromise. And before you know it, he had become one of the city aldermen. He had been elevated to the position of mayor. He had lost his influence. His own children mocked his brand of belief in God. And out on the hills, there was Abraham, lonely in his appeal to God, asking God to find 10 men out of whom he could rescue Sodom. He refused to go in, and it became the means by which the only ones who could come out finally came out. Now, what kind of witness are you? What kind am I? I'm embarrassed to even ask the question of myself. Let's look at another contrast. There's a contrast here between two kinds of goodness in these two men. One of them represents preventive goodness. When sin has already been unleashed in the earth, the Obadiahs come along and say, well, I think I ought to do something about this. And so they gather the 100 prophets of God, the 100 people of God, the prophets of the Lord, and take them over into a cave, hoping nobody will see so that they can get away with taking care of the Christians here and the world will not know anything about it. This is preventive goodness. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I know I sound disparaging of that, but thank God for preventive goodness. It's better than none at all. But the other kind of goodness is aggressive goodness. Obadiah is the preventive representative. He's the one who represents the preventive goodness. He sought simply to prevent a great harm from being done. Well, friends, it's not enough to deal with a poison stream in society. God calls on us to go to the headwaters and throw some healing mechanism into the fountainhead so that the entirety of the stream will be pure, instead of waiting at the foot of the cliff to gather the remains of sin as it has come cascading over. We build a barrier at the top. A barrier at the top, and we call people aggressively to not fall over that precipice. Now, Obadiah waits at the bottom to gather up the remains and to do what he can to rescue. Elijah stands at the top and aggressively warns the nation and calls it to God. You see, Obadiah would read Jesus as saying, you're the sugar of the earth. Elijah would read Jesus as saying, you're the salt of the earth. Sugar is palatable. Salt stings. Obadiah wanted to be palatable and sweet. Elijah realized that you couldn't heal without stinging the sore spot in order to introduce the healing processes. So two kinds of goodness. Then you have a contrast between two responses to danger when that danger originates for a child of God from some point of evil. Two responses to danger. On the one hand, you have the response of Obadiah. His response was, be cautious. Compromise. Don't go to the point of hurt. I want you to listen again to verses 9 through 14. Listen carefully. And Obadiah said, what have I sinned that you would deliver your servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me? This is caution. This is compromise. Now, I can understand it, as can you. If we were in his shoes, we probably would be more Obadiah than Elijah. There may not be an Elijah among us. He said, as the Lord thy God liveth, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord hath not sent to seek thee. And when they said he's not there, King Ahab took an oath of the kingdom and nation that they had not found thee. And now thou sayest, go tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone from thee, that the Spirit of the Lord shall carry thee where I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find thee, he shall slay me. But I, thy servant, fear the Lord from my youth. Was it not told my Lord what I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now thou sayest, go tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah is here, and he shall slay me. Here's a man who was more anxious for his own welfare than he was for the cause of God. Does that embarrass you? It embarrasses me. Many is the time, I fear, when I've stood at the crossroads of crisis decision when some procedure of God was very much at stake, and I made the wrong choice, going down the wrong fork of the road just for my own security and my own safety. If you were honest, you would say exactly the same thing. The world was not populated by a cross and a redemptive power released in society by people who skirted responsibility for the sake of convenience and self-preservation and self-will. This is one response. This is Obadiah. Then there's Elijah. In verse 15, we find that God was more real to Elijah than Ahab was. And the fear of God had made him insensitive to all other fears that he might face. And so he became the human redeemer in Israelite society of that day. I remember reading one of the most fascinating books I ever read was Roland Bainton's historic account of Martin Luther as he set the tides of the Protestant Reformation in motion in the early 1500s in Germany and in Europe. And I remember how he tells, as Luther finally crystallized his position, Luther was a man subject to awful despondency, where he would just get down in the throes of an awful kind of despair and despondency, and his wife was a bolstering point for him, and sometimes the cause would have been lost if it had not been for his wife. He became so despairing, and the entire course of world history was changed because he was able to be brought up out of these things as somebody bolstered him. He finally crystallized his position. The 95 Theses were nailed on the door of the church in Wittenberg. And you know what happened? It was like God raised a hammer and smashed the institution of the corrupt Roman Catholic Church of that day. And the Pope himself gave dispatch after dispatch to clear the earth of this kind of thing, because the entire institution was beginning to shake and totter and rock back and forth under the impulse and impact of a person who actually wanted to reform it from the inside and never intended to step outside and was forced to the outside. And the time came for his trial. He was placed in chains. He was transported across country to a little village where the tribunal of the Roman Catholic Church was set up to face him and he to face them. And you remember his great statement when they said, "Recant or else." He said, "I cannot recant, because to act in violation of conscience is neither right nor safe. Here I stand, so help me God, I cannot do otherwise." You know what decided that for him? In Luther's own words, he said, "As I approached the village, and the crowds were passing up and down the road on either side, and the guards were holding them out," he said, "there was an old German knight that broke through the ranks. And he came up next to my beast that I was traveling on. And he said, 'Sir Martin,' he said, 'if you know God is in this, and you know you're right, then go on into it with all the force God puts in you, though there be as many devils to oppose you as there are tiles along the rooftop as you approach the place of your judgment.'" And Martin Luther said that was the thing that bolstered him for the times ahead when he would stand before Pope and people to decide the history, the current of Europe and the world. Now, this is the kind of man Elijah was. Knowing God, that God was in it, and he stood face to face with God, realizing that things were not right even among the people of God. He was able to stand four square because he had determined that no matter what danger came to him, if God wanted to, he was able to sustain him. And God used that kind of man to rechannel redemptively the history and the course of a nation's practice, out of whom Jesus finally arrived on the world scene to redeem it from its sins. There's one last contrast here. There's a contrast between the two kinds of receptions that are always given to these two kinds of men by the world, by ungodly people. Ahab faced both of these men. He faced Obadiah, and he responded.